Good morning.
Good morning.
Mumenkin, case number 8. Getan said to a monk, Kechu made 100 carts. If we took off the wheels and removed the axle, what would then be obvious? Thirty spokes go to the hub of a wheel, but the use of it depends upon the empty space there. Clay is needed to make a pot, but the empty space inside is what makes the pot useful. Doors and windows are opened into a room, but it is the empty space which gives the room its use. Thus, the usefulness of the existence of things derives from non-existence. This past week, I received a request from the American Friends Service Committee, the Quaker Social Action Organization, and they are in the process of re-editing their booklet on perspectives of the various religious traditions regarding capital punishment. And I was asked to provide a statement from a Zen Buddhist perspective. And this is what I sent them. A statement in opposition to capital punishment from a Zen Buddhist perspective. Zen Buddhism in America is not a corporate entity. It is not a belief system with a central agreed-upon set of beliefs to which all who would be called Zen Buddhists adhere. In my heart of hearts, I hope it never becomes so. I can only speak from my own perspective as an American Rinzai Zen Buddhist priest who has witnessed firsthand the horrific spectacle of a human being murdered in a state-sanctioned, choreographed execution. I know of other Buddhists who actively support the death penalty. This occurs more than we might like to admit in so-called spiritual communities. It matters little to members of these communities if the so-called leadership pronounces from on high that the death penalty, or any other practice for that matter, is objectionable as a matter of faith. We do not have to look too far to recognize that members of traditions that have declared practices such as birth control to be contrary to the tenets of faith are in large part ignored by the body of the community. You see, if we're really interested in the truth, we have to recognize that hierarchical, patriarchal, or any other power over dynamic that may be practiced over groups of people cannot be spirituality. It can be called religion in the popular sense, because power over dynamics are at the heart of organized corporate religions. Genuine spirituality is anarchistic in nature. By that I mean that spirituality involves profound questioning of all authority, scriptural, dogmatic, hierarchical, clerical, and even commonly held beliefs. Anarchy here does not imply chaos in the sense I am using the term. It requires deep responsibility. Spiritual anarchy, if you will, does not connote a lack of discipline, precision, or perception. It actually fosters these characteristics. The Zen Buddhist tradition is as unique for each Zen practitioner as their fingerprints or the patterns of their irises. There is no belief involved in Zen practice, since it is an experiential tradition based on the direct practice and experience of spirituality. So as a consequence, there can be no dogmatic statement made by any practitioner that will hold for all others. There are differences of perception in Zen and in truth in all traditions. That is human nature. To rely on dogma does great disservice to spiritual practice and relegates us to the role of automatons operating under the direction of external authority. It could almost be seen as a tendency towards spiritual fascism, the ultimate expression of spiritual materialism and the denial of human potential. Having said all that, I can only present the viewpoint of one simple Zen Buddhist priest. I oppose the death penalty as I oppose all murder, as I oppose the imposition of suffering on all beings through the action of the individual, group, or state. My opposition is based on simply my own choice. It does not rely on any scriptural command of my tradition, any dogma, any external coercion, or any commandment from above. My opposition is my responsibility. It is my ability to respond. Who I am is who I choose to be, consciously and deliberately. I am not who I am told to be. I choose for myself to adhere to the first precept of Buddhism that goes something like this. I am reverential and mindful of all life. I am not violent, and I do not kill. Precepts in the Buddhist tradition are not commandments. They are simply expressions of ways of being, which we may or may not choose to manifest. I choose to manifest this precept based on my life experience, my perceptions of reality, and my choice to contribute to the betterment of society by not causing suffering to others. Zen, I suppose, is a very simple tradition. No dogma, no commandments, no authority. Above us, only sky and dynamic peace. Precepts within the tradition are not not emphasized very much in that, in a lot of ways, it is too easy to relate to them as commandments, as dogma, as rigid, externally imposed rules and restrictions. Like the empty space in the wheel, like the empty space within the pot, within the bowl, that makes these constructs useful. The Ten Precepts likewise, as a matter of choice, become useful in living our lives creatively. And as stated, this is very much a matter of choice. This is not a commandment from the great Buddha in the sky, or the wizened grand Puba who leads us all. There are a number of interpretations of the Ten Precepts, and some of them are very much based on the Western connotation of the Ten Commandments, and as such almost read like commandments. But the translation that I use and that I created specifically for use within the Engage Zen Foundation, and specifically for use by prisoners, are very much a statement of choice and a matter of a positive statement of things as they are, rather than something that we are commanded to follow or that we would like to be so. It's somewhat more purposeful than that. And these are the Ten Precepts as translated in this manner. I am reverential and mindful with all life. I am not violent. I do not kill. I respect the property of others. I do not steal. I am conscious and loving in my relationships. I do not lust. I honor honesty and truth. I do not deceive. I exercise proper care of my body-mind. I am not gluttonous. I don't abuse drugs. I recognize that silence is precious. I do not gossip or engage in frivolous talk. I am humble. I do not praise myself or judge others. I am satisfied with myself. I do not covet or indulge in envy or jealousy. I keep my mind calm and at peace. I do not indulge in anger. I esteem the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I do not defame them. These are the 10 fundamental precepts. A matter of choice. Ways of being which we may or may not choose to manifest. The important point is that it is our choice. So, having spoken all that, thank you for your attention. Are there any questions or commentary?
10 precepts common throughout.
The question is, are the 10 precepts common throughout all schools of Buddhism? Yes, they are. In some schools, they have 15 precepts. They're held in various configurations. They're expressed in various manner, depending on the specific school. The precepts are common to both monks and lay people. Some would call these lay precepts, although they are pretty fundamental also to monks and nuns. The structure of the discipline of monks and nuns is laid out in a document, which is really an extensive set of volumes called the Vinaya, which forms a segment of the Pali canon and denotes actually hundreds of rules that apply to monks, and hundreds plus, I think, 42 some odd other precepts that apply to nuns. So the nuns have to follow more precepts than the monks, which is rather sexist, I think, from this perspective, but and patriarchal, not to mention patriarchal. And they are, you know, quite precise and really very picayune, you know, having to do with things such as how many robes someone may own, how many bowls one may have, when they can eat, when they wash, you know, how often they shave, you know, endless rules and regulations for monastic life. And these things have been around for over 2,000 years. They are not necessarily completely followed within the Zen tradition. Although we are based in the Vinaya, the Zen tradition is somewhat more relaxed regarding the following of the Vinaya by monks. But again, it comes to, I think a lot of it has to do with culture, with maintaining control, and maintaining control of the community. And these things were seen as necessary at the time in order to maintain control. So very tricky business, I think, when we get into fundamentalism in any religious tradition, you know, there are problems with it. You know, there are really some serious problems with it, and you know, we do have fundamental intelligence, which really requires our active participation in making you know, life decisions. We cannot go around you know, as slaves to written dogma or rules. That becomes just another cop-out, another way of attempting to avoid responsibility. So the Zen tradition, and in specifically the American Zen tradition, if indeed such a thing can be even conceived of, places responsibility very much in the hands of the individual. So it's up to you. Up to you. Pardon?
May I add my two cents? They're a beautiful statement.
Thank you. Yeah, it very much is. And you know, again, I think that this also ties into the Buddhist teaching of karma and vipaka, which we don't properly investigate in the West. We hear, that's your karma, all the time. That's your karma, baby. You know, our instant karma's gonna get ya. But there is karma in the original term karma means literally action. And specifically it means volitional action. action, mere action, is not considered karma without volition. And vipaka is the result of karma. Now, it's very easy to sit in front of a lectern, in front of a group of people, and say, this is karma, and this is vipaka, this is cause, and this is effect. In real life, it is impossible to say where karma begins and ends, and where vipaka begins and ends, because we live in a continuum. So, you know, one cause is results in this effect, which becomes the cause of another effect, and so on and so on and so on. I mean, it's very, very easy on a theoretical basis to say that, you know, this is karma, this is vipaka, this is cause and this is effect. Very easy to say that on a theoretical level. On a practical level, it's impossible to determine where one begins and the other ends. So, you know, we constantly misuse, I think, the term karma in the particularly in the West. Karma just means action. It does not imply result. That's your karma. Really is incorrect. It's more accurate to say your karma has produced your vipaka, and that is your vipaka. That is the result of your karma, the result of your action. Karma itself is just simply action. And simply volitional action. A lot of times in the Buddhist tradition, I think people hold or adopt this notion that it's all karma. Well, it ain't all karma. There are things that happen that do not involve karma. Non-volitional action. It's not karma. You know, when we go walking down the street and we step on an ant with total non-awareness of the fact that we're killing a living creature, this isn't karma. But if one's walking across our kitchen floor and we go down and whack it, that's karma, baby. Because there's volition involved in that. Karma refers to volitional action. There are things that happen in the universe that do not involve karma. And if we follow this idea, this notion that somehow we live and that everything is karma, then we have set ourselves up with the nightmare of a totally deterministic universe. A universe that is you know, a fascist nightmare. There's no freedom in such a universe. There's no chance for random action. There are random events that take place, have nothing to do with karma. You know, you're sitting in the meditation hall and a meteorite comes through the ceiling and crashes down on the altar in front of you and you awaken to tremendous enlightenment. Well, that ain't karma, that just happened. There are other things besides karma that happen in the universe. And we've got to get used to the fact that it ain't all karma. That I think is a mistaken notion. We live in a much more flexible and freer universe. It's not all predetermined. You know, I mean, if we looked at some of our ideas of karma, that everything that happens or that we do or everything like that is all karma, then we make the mistake of really pigeonholing ourselves into an absolute deterministic universe. There's no longer any room for change. It becomes a very mechanistic type of cosmology, and this is a mistaken notion, I think, and it's also an excuse. You know, hey, it's my karma. You know, what can I tell you? You know. You know, yeah, I'm a son of a bitch, but you know, that's just the result of my karma. You know, I'm a victim of my upbringing, my circumstances, and all of that. It's my karma. I can't help it. So there are other forces in operation besides karma. And we should remember that there are random actions that are non-karmic in character. So I will have, and I do have copies of the statement. I think it's going to be printed in the American Friends Service Committee book. I think the fourth or fifth edition is coming out, and this statement will be there representing Zen Buddhism. Which really it can't. But I think it's refreshing in that the rest of the statements from all of the other churches and bodies are, you know, full of whereases and where to fors and, you know, here and afters and all of that stuff. You know, be it hereby resolved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I mean, that's all well and good, but, you know, this is not about hierarchy. Anarchy. Yeah, anarchy. Spiritual anarchy. But fully responsible anarchy in that it rejects the notion of authority. And the Buddha himself, in his sutra on the examination of truth, states very much these facts. Don't trust scripture. Don't listen and follow something because the monk said it. Don't accept dogma. Question commonly held beliefs. don't accept things that have just been accepted by others because that's what others believe. Look and examine and question and look and respond and penetrate these things for yourself. So, have a good day.